From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, something punk and country music have in common, John Langford. He's a founding member of one of the longest-lasting punk bands, the Mekons. He plays with the country-inspired group the Waco Brothers and has a new CD paying tribute to the father of Western swing, Bob Wills. Langford also draws the comic strip, Great Pop Things, which satirizes rock and roll history. The strips are collected in a new book. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring the music of American composer John Harbison, and book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends some books for holiday gifts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A second wave of bombing against Iraq has begun. Today, President Clinton said the decision to attack Iraq was difficult but right. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton met in the Oval Office today with the vice president and his national security team. He was getting a briefing about the damage the U.S. bombing raids have caused. He said he was convinced the decision to order the strikes was in the interest of the United States and in the interest of people around the world. The president was asked about comments by Republican leaders Trent Lott and Dick Armey that the order was made to divert attention from impeachment. The president said that's not true.
I don't think any serious person would believe that any president would do such a thing. And I don't believe any reasonably astute person in Washington would believe that Secretary Cohen and General Shelton and the whole rest of the national security team would participate in such an action.
And the president points out that other Republicans, such as Senators Jesse Helms, John McCain, John Warner, and Richard Lugar, support the action. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Defense Secretary William Cohen said he was satisfied with the success of the first wave of airstrikes against Iraqi targets. At the Pentagon this morning, Cohen told NPR the White House is sensitive to the start of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan that begins this weekend, but he says airstrikes will continue.
We will not put any artificial restrictions on when we decide the mission has been completed. We will try to complete it as quickly as we can, but there's no firm fixed date that upon which it would end.
Defense Secretary Richard Cohen. Former President Jimmy Carter has issued a statement supporting the airstrikes against Iraq. He says these attacks are not connected to President Clinton's impeachment proceedings. Joshua Leves of member station WABE reports from Atlanta.
Former President Carter says it has been clear since early November that there would be military action without further debate if Saddam Hussein again violated his pledge to allow unrestricted UN weapons inspections. Carter says the American strikes were launched only after U.S. Ambassador Richard Butler reported that Iraq had violated the pledge. Carter says American leaders played no role in the timing of Iraq's decisions. He calls the allegations by some lawmakers that the president would launch the attack for political purposes, unjust and ill-advised. And he says that while Americans may not agree that the bombing is justified, Iraq's violations cannot be related to political events in Washington. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Reuters News Service says the United States has closed 40 of its embassies in Africa for the next 2 days. Only 3 posts remain open in South Africa, Nigeria, and Burkina Faso. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 77 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, amid global uncertainty prompted by the joint American-British attack against Iraq, U.S. markets are mostly higher today. NPR's business correspondent Jack Spear reports.
Despite the air and cruise missile attack against Iraq by U.S. and British forces and the fact the market generally doesn't like international turmoil, blue-chip stocks are higher at midday. Stocks rose shortly after the opening bell this morning in large measure due to some positive earnings news from a major U.S. bank and a smaller-than-expected trade shortfall for the month of October. Chase Manhattan, the country's third biggest bank, announced today it expects its earnings for the fourth quarter to top analysts' expectations. That sent Chase stock up more than $4 a share today. The government also reported the difference between what we sent to foreign countries and what they shipped to us actually fell by 1.2% in October. Oil shares, which had risen following the U.S. attack, dropped back a bit today. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Hudson Foods and two of its employees have been charged with trying to hide information about the widespread tainting of hamburger last year. 16 people were sickened last year by the beef, which was linked to a potentially deadly E. coli outbreak. 25 million pounds of beef were recalled under heavy pressure by the Agriculture Department. A grand jury in Lincoln, Nebraska, accused the company and the workers with conspiring to conceal the severity of the outbreak and to give the federal government false information about the matter. Again, our top stories, the United States and Great Britain have begun a second wave of airstrikes against Iraq today. Pentagon officials say the first round of airstrikes conducted yesterday produced severe damage to some targets. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, singer-guitarist John Langford, is a founding member of the British punk band The Meekons, one of the few punk bands of the era that is still performing. Critic Robert Christgau says they've put out as much good music as anybody in rock and roll. Langford is Welsh, but now lives in Chicago. Living in the States is feeding his growing interest in country music. He plays in the country-inspired band The Waco Brothers, and he pays tribute to the father of Western Swing on his new CD, The Pine Valley Cosmonauts Salute the Majesty of Bob Wills. Langford recently released his first solo CD called Skull Orchard. Langford is also a visual artist and, under the pen name Chuck Death, draws the syndicated comic strip Great Pop Things, which satirizes rock and roll history. The strips are collected in the new book Great Pop Things. Let's get started with a track from the Bob Wills tribute record. Here's Langford singing Sweet Kind of Love.
To me, I can't understand. You got a sweet kind of love, and I feel bright and grooming when you hold my hand. You got a sweet kind. Dimples and wink your little eye. I'm full of goose pimples and you're my sweetie pie. Everything about you fits you like a glove. You got a sweet kind of love.
John Langford, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you first come across Bob Wills, and how did he strike you the first time you heard his music?
It was not like the country music I'd heard in England growing up. We didn't think much of country music, really. We were punk rockers, and we thought punk rock was really exciting, and everything else that went before it was pretty boring. And Bob Wills was just this music that kind of leapt off. I think the thing that struck me most about it was how timeless it was. It didn't sound old to me. It sounded like very much alive. And I kind of imagined falsely that possibly that was what was still going on somewhere in Texas.
No, when you were living in England and still playing kind of punk rock and listening to Bob Wills, did you ever imagine yourself playing that kind of country or country swing, you know, Western swing music yourself?
No, absolutely not. I started listening to people like Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams around that time, and people had pointed out parallels between what we did and those people. And I felt that there were parallels between punk rock and country music because of the focus of the lyrics. It was very, I felt that people like Merle Haggard or Hank Williams were writing for their peers, and what was actually being talked about was very realistic. It wasn't kind of escapist stuff like the lyrics of most rock music. And the structures were very simple. Bob Wills is a different kettle of fish altogether because there was obviously fantastic musicianship there. But I think he just had a strange, open-minded vision of what music could be, in the sense that he came from very traditional fiddle music into swing and big band stuff. And I think he was a bit of an avant-gardist, in a way.
Let me put in a couple of the differences between Western swing and punk music. Punk music has this really hard driving beat, whereas Western swing has this more like, kind of like lilting swing to it. More.
But Bob had the big beat, though, because I think he was the first guy to use drums on the Grand Ole Opry.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he was very concerned about it being thumping and dancing. I think when somebody asked him in 1958 or something what he thought about rock and roll, he said, oh, we've been doing that for 30 years. You
know, so. Okay, and another thing, a lot of punk songs were almost kind of shouting songs, not about song craft as we think of it. Whereas, country music, all of country music is so dependent on song craft and professional songwriters and all that.
Yeah, but there's still, the people I like, there's still a simplicity to the songs and a simplicity to the sentiments that they're expressing, which I felt, related to what we were trying to do with punk music. I mean, punk music is a strange genre because I think a lot of people think of, the Mohicans and the leather jackets of the early 80s punks rather than what I thought was very broad and open-minded stuff that was going on in the late 70s in England, where kind of anything was possible.
Now, what pop music did you grow up with in Wales?
When I was a kid, the first thing that I really liked was a band called Slade, and that kind of glam rock stuff, because I think I was probably about 12 or 13 years old, and I probably wanted to be a football hooligan and didn't have the wherewithal to do anything about it. And then Slade and bands like that seemed to be kind of like the sort of football hooligan element. They sort of brought that into pop music, and they were like a skinhead band who went all glam and wore outrageous outfits and big boots and very strange looking back on it, but quite boisterous and like noisy, and T-Rex as well, and kind of got into Hawkwind and Black Sabbath and that heavy metal stuff, but only the kind of crudest, most brutal stuff that I liked. And then punk rock happened, and then you had the Clash and the Sex Pistols, and that was...
And what year was the Mekons formed, your band?
We formed in 1977, pretty much after the Sex Pistols came on forget what the name of that tour was, like the White Riot Tour or something like that, or the Anarchy Tour, and they came with the Clash and the Damned and Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, and they played at Leeds Polytechnic, and it was just, anyone can be in a band. We don't have to be able to play instruments to be in a band.
Did you feel that was the only way you could be in a band? The only way you could be in a band was if anybody could be in a band?
Yeah, that's what, it really galvanized people. You didn't have to make music like music that was made before. You didn't have to be like The Who. You didn't have to write rock operas and have orchestras playing with you and have huge banks of keyboards. And you could just pick up a guitar and play one chord and you could be in a band and you could have something that you could say.
Let me read something that the rock critic Grill Marcus said about you in his book, Lipstick Traces. He said, the Mekons were best known as the band that took punk ideology most seriously. Those who couldn't play tried to learn, and those who could tried to forget. Did you fit into either of those two categories?
I had a drum kit. I was very interested in being in a band for quite a long time, but never kind of really got it together. So I actually had a drum kit that I bought off someone, and I took it up to Leeds when I went up there to go to art college. So I was in demand. Because I had a drum kit. I couldn't actually play them very well, but I was definitely in demand because you had to have a drum kit. So I was, me and Tom were in the same studio in art school, and he just said one day, are we going to form a band? And I was like, oh, really? Yeah, it's going to be good because no one's going to be able to play. I was going, oh, can I be in it then? And he said, like, yeah, it'd be good. You've got a drum kit. Yeah, we were going to ask you to be in it. So
I want to play one of the early Mekons recordings and get a sense of what the band was like early in its career. Why don't you choose one of the early records and introduce it for us?
This is off the album we did for Virgin Records called The Quality of Mercy Is Not Strunnen, and this song's called What Are We Gonna Do Tonight? What are we gonna do tonight?
man. Grind the telly.
Milk cane.
Gun Sundays.
Pop star.
Fashion on record.
Actually really good discordant playing in that too. I like that.
Oh yeah, we were we perfected that very early on.
Did you get technically accomplished as time went on?
That's why I gave up playing the drums, because I knew that there was no way I was ever going to become technically accomplished at that. But I can play the guitar a little bit now. I think it's more about knowing a few tricks rather than being an accomplished musician.
My guest is John Langford, co-founder of the Mekons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, John Langford, is co-founder of the punk band The Mekons, and he draws the syndicated comic strip Great Pop Things. His strips are collected in a new book. Now, you've said that the first slogan of The Mekons was, "No personalities emerge." Why did you want to not make it the kind of band that had a star fronting it?
We had a huge manifesto.
What else was in it?
Oh, there was loads of things like, we will never make a record, we will never have our photograph taken, we will only be the support band, we'll be the punk band that plays slow songs, not fast songs. Mostly all those things crumbled before the first gig, because the guy refused to book us. Said like, we said, we're going to be like a punk band, but we're going to play slow songs. And he's like, well, you can't play then, because you've got to play fast. And we're like, oh, no. So then we had to go back and write some more songs, because we didn't have enough. If we played them fast, they weren't long enough. So we only had about 15 minutes of music for the first gig. But somebody came along at the first gig. There's a band called the Rosillos from Edinburgh, and their manager was a guy called Bob Last, and he was setting up a little record label. And he just said, do you want to make a record? And we were like, no, we're not going to make a record. Oh, it'd be quite good to make a record, wouldn't it? Yes, we'd like to make a record. And then the NME wouldn't publish a feature of us unless we had a photograph of the band. So we stood in some trees miles away, and some guy took some photographs of us standing in these trees so he couldn't see who anyone was. And then they rejected that, so they said, we won't write about you unless you have a photograph. So we built some dummies out of coat hangers and paint tins and sent them that, and they wouldn't have that. So in the end, they sent some photographer up for London. We all stood dutifully by and had our photographs taken. So there were many things. We always knew with the Mekons what we didn't want to be, and it was kind of what we were was what was left. So,
well, let me get back to the manifesto. Were you one of the writers of the manifesto? Did you want a manifesto?
Yeah, I think we thought that was really. We were, you know, it was year zero, and you know, this is it. You know, we were cutting up the punk, the decadence of rock and roll music at the root. We were punk rockers, and that was it. It's very important to us that, you know, everything was justified.
Did you feel like a sellout when you violated all the principles of the manifesto right away?
No, not really. Because half of it was just the love of wanting to do it.
Uh-huh.
It was so quite exciting.
What did you hate in pop music at the time?
All that progressive rock stuff, you know. And I just couldn't stand it. Most of my friends really liked The Who. And if The Who did a kind of four-album rock opera, everyone would run out and buy it. And I just thought that was the most depressing thing imaginable. So I really didn't like it. I thought mostly they were very pompous, and I thought most pop stars were hilarious. I mean, like Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd. I mean, still cracks me up now if I hear that. I just think it's like ludicrous.
Why?
Megalomania.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Just somebody think that their opinions are that important. It's strange.
Would you sing a few bars of the first song that you wrote for the Mekons?
The first song?
Mm-hmm. You could do one of the early songs then.
We used to write everything collectively. So we had a song called Never Been in a Riot. So if you want me to sing it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't used to sing, we used to shout.
Right.
He just went, never been in a riot, dum, dum, dum. Never been in a fight, dum, dum, dum. How come for me everything turns out all right, turns out right, turns out right. That was the first verse. It was a kind of an answer record to The Clash's White Riot, which we thought, I liked The Clash, but I thought it was completely irresponsible and insane to write a song called White Riot, Wanna Riot. You know, I didn't understand what they were talking about with that and thought they were, I thought they were encroaching on the same sort of pomposity that, you know, the progressive rockers had as well. I mean, they had, The Clash were a great band, but had a lot of unfortunate things about them as well. So we did that as the first single, as a kind of answer to that. Like, because we assumed they were just nice middle-class boys who'd never been in a riot anyway. So, and we knew we were, so we just said, white riot, and we'd, you know, never been in a riot, never been in a fight.
So the band was, in a way, about not following all the big commercial principles of rock and roll. And,
yeah, totally.
And you succeeded in not becoming a big commercially successful band.
We succeeded, Terry. We did succeed. That's right. Thank you for saying that. A secret of our success is our lack of success.
I think you had something like 11 different record companies.
Yeah, yeah, we've always had kind of fairly... Some of those record companies were actually ourselves, so...
Oh, even you couldn't take it.
No, we used to... Yeah, we used to... We would fire ourselves quite regularly.
Who would jump out first and with most of your record... Did they want out or did you want out?
Usually we wanted out. Usually it was just like situations that weren't going anywhere. I mean, with major labels, we were fired by Virgin, which was kind of predictable. Because I don't know why they even signed us in the first place. It's just that kind of madness, the sort of feeding frenzy that goes on when something new comes out. All these A&R men who think they know the secret of everything that's commercial run around with their checkbooks wide open trying to sign everything. So they signed the Mekons, and it was like obviously not a commercial band in any way. More so when we signed to A&M in 1989, we signed kind of more with our eyes open, and we signed because we thought there was some theory by which a band like ourselves could exist on a major label and could make records quite cheaply and sell a modest amount of records but still make the record company money. But after the guy who'd set up that deal left, a load of accountants come along and they, you know, what are these people doing on the label? And yeah, it's a very good question. We don't belong on a major label. It's never been a very happy experience. I've always felt like an employee when I've been on a major label. And uh-huh. But then again, some independent labels have been excruciatingly bad to us as well. So, not Touch and Go in Chicago. That's the longest we've ever been on a record label, is Touch and Go. And they've just been great. We just say, can we have some money? And they say, okay. We go and do things with it.
During the punk days, I think a fair number of people would show up at concerts in some venues and think that it was really cool to throw things at the band or to, you know, act very aggressively.
To spit at the band, yeah.
So what were some of the things that happened at some of your concerts that you didn't appreciate?
People getting stabbed and members of the band being beaten senseless.
When did that happen?
At a Rock Against Racism gig in Newcastle.
Oh, perfect. Huh?
In the dressing room. There's a band called the Angelic Upstarts were meant to be playing, and apparently they didn't turn up, so their fans decided to beat the living crap out of the rest of us, so... It was kind of a scary time. That's why the Mekons made a conscious decision not to play live after about 1980. We just didn't want to play. We didn't play till maybe 83, something like that.
Were you almost afraid of your own fans?
I just thought it turned into a very hideous, violent scene. Punk was meant to be this wide-open thing where everything was acceptable, and it became like if you didn't have the leather jacket, the Mohican, you didn't play fast and pretend to be really stupid, which is what most punk bands seem to want to do. That would be really right-wing, because there's a lot of really right-wing punk bands at that time. And we played to crowds with people Sieg Heiling, you know, who would then be, you know, we would shoot our mouths off at them, and then they'd be waiting for us outside after the gig. You know, that happened a couple of times. Pretty scary.
Did you ask yourself, how did this happen? How did it happen that the music hardened into this caricature and that the fans somehow interpreted the music as being so compatible with fascism?
I think the industry got the lid on it, you know. It became a commercial prospect for the music industry. When it was interesting, it was because no one knew where it was going or what was happening. And it turned into a very unpleasant cul-de-sac quite quickly. And we decided we didn't want anything to do with it, so we didn't play live till about 83. And we put out records, but very bedroom-orientated records. We would stay at home and sing into tape recorders.
Did you miss performing?
Yeah, I did. I'm not sure. It was such an unpleasant situation. I didn't really miss it. I wanted to play in a band. I liked the idea of playing, but I started working on playing the guitar, and I formed another band called the Three Johns, who played a lot. When I first came to the States, it was with the Three Johns, and that was like a little drum machine, rock guitar trio, and they were just my friends. And it seemed to change by the mid '80s. It had changed a lot. That's something that tide had died out, but it got very ugly for a while.
Let me ask you to choose a Mikan's recording that you particularly like.
I choose one off the new album, actually, because it's my favorite at the moment. So there's a song called Flip Flop, which is pretty inexplicable.
And how new is the new album?
The new album came out in June, I think, May or June.
Okay, let's hear it. And the album's called Me.
It's called Me. All songs written by me.
That's Flip Flop from the Mikan's latest CD called Me. Mikan's co-founder John Langford will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by Little Brown & Company, publisher of Holiday on Ice, by NPR commentator David Sedaris, available in paperback in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mikan's co-founder John Langford. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan has some gift ideas, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD featuring the music of American composer John Harbison. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Langford. He's a founding member of the British punk band The Mekons, which is still together after more than 20 years. But the band members live in different places. In fact, Langford lives in Chicago and has a number of other projects besides his work with The Mekons. He plays in a couple of country-inspired bands. He's also a painter and has had several shows this year. And he draws the syndicated comic Great Pop Things under the pen name Chuck Death. You have many different incarnations now. You know, there's the Mekons, there's the Bob Wills tribute record you put together. You have a band called the Waco Brothers. I want to play something from your Waco Brothers album. Where do the Waco Brothers?
Well, I moved to Chicago about 1992, and I had absolutely nothing to do there whatsoever. And so I always wanted to be in a band. The Mekons were always so stretched geographically. Even when we were all living in England, people lived in London, people lived in Leeds, people lived elsewhere. Steve, the drummer, had already moved to Chicago. And I felt like it would be nice to be in a band where everyone lived in the same neighborhood so we could get together and, you know, actually play in your hometown, become a band. Chicago's big enough where you can become a band of some note just by playing around Chicago. And that was the intention of the Waco Brothers. And I wanted to play the songs of people like George Jones, Hank Williams, Merle Haggard. Simple, straight, you know, pumped up country, honky-tonk country music. That was something I tried to do in Leeds and no one would take me seriously whatsoever.
Why'd you name it the Waco Brothers?
I didn't, actually. It had many names. We used to change the name every week in case people recognized us and wouldn't come again because we were so awful when we started. But I don't know, I think it was that weekend with the Waco thing went on and I went away and somebody had to do a poster. And I think that was the first time we played a gig that was actually any good. And the Waco Brothers is kind of a sick name at the time, but I think the meaning is dissolved a little bit now. So,
well, I thought we could play Arizona Rose from this, and this is a song that you wrote and sing lead on. Tell us about the song, what inspired it.
A friend of mine from Leeds moved to New York and got married and had a kid. And he named it Arizona Rose. And I said, that sounds like the title of a song. And we just started doing the Waco Brothers thing. And Bloodshot Records wanted us to make an album. And I had no idea what we were going to do for an album. But I thought it would be a really bad idea to do an album of country covers. So let's try and write a few songs. So I wrote this song with a guy called Tom Ray, who was the bass player in the band at the time. And he actually said, that sounds like a song. Because I said to my friend on the phone, I said, I'll give my love to Arizona. So there you have it.
Okay, and here it is, John Langford with the Waco Brothers.
Oh, give my love to Arizona. To Arizona Rose. She's in New York and I can't phone her. She left no number. Just had to go. Now all of the starlight and all of the memories, they're still out there, out there on the plain. But oh, my heart, it's such a dry place. Ashes of love, where once there were flames.
That's Arizona Rose from the Waco Brothers album. My guest is John Langford, who sang lead and co-wrote the song. I think it's fair to say that you seem to have a love-hate relationship with country music. You love a lot of music and hate a lot of the commercialism and trappings surrounding it.
The industry is problematic for me. I mean, a lot of the people who run the country music industry in Nashville are kind of shoe salesmen and I think who made their money in other industries and apply the same kind of logic to music. But I don't necessarily think that's the best way to be selling music.
You did an art piece called The Death of Country Music, a series of tombstones. Would you describe first what some of the tombstones are like?
They were like great big lumps of granite. So they were difficult to transport. And they had pictures of Hank Williams on them. And because I thought as a kind of symbol, more than anything else. And they said kind of mean things about the country music industry. And we planned to put them outside some of the offices of the big companies on Music Row. And then friends of mine in Nashville told me that they wouldn't last 2 minutes, even though they were really big and really heavy. So we didn't do that, but we had a show at a gallery called the American Pop Culture Gallery in Nashville, which was interesting because a lot of people came down to the show from the business side of things and kind of quietly said how they agreed that maybe there was some point to what I was doing.
My guest is John Langford, co-founder of the Mekons. He has several bands, and he's also a visual artist, and he has a new book as well. It's a kind of satirical comic history of rock and roll from Elvis to Oasis called Great Pop Things. This is a very funny book, and one of the kind of premises throughout the book is that a lot of rock stars think they're going to change the world and, of course, fail. And the ways that they seem to be trying to change it are kind of absurd and trivial. So a list of examples, the Velvet Underground, they tried to change the world with their nihilism and their sunglasses. John Lennon, he tried to make world peace by taking all his clothes off. Tom Waits, he tried to change the world by making that token weird album that normal people have in their record collections. The Grateful Dead tried to change the world by playing continuously since 1966. Brian Eno tried to change the world by turning it on its side and calling it something else. Do you think it's kind of pretentious when pop stars say that they want to change the world?
I think pop music has the capacity to be very meaningful to people. But I think a lot of pop stars go far overboard. And I think the turning point for me and Carlton, who's the guy I collaborate with on this, was probably Live Aid and seeing the kind of the lengths that people went to at that time. And yeah, I think music's maybe a reflection of things that go on rather than being a kind of catalyzing force. And the book is basically just pinpricks and just a lampoon those people that are, who believe otherwise or don't see themselves as part of the problem, maybe.
And I'll remind our listeners, this is spoken by somebody who once had a pop manifesto.
I did have a pop manifesto.
So you should know.
Yep. I'm just jealous, basically. We do mean strips about Bono from U2 because he's got more money than we have. It's the only way to get back at him.
Now, you have a satiric take on a Grateful Dead lyric in here. Do you remember the lyric?
There's a lot of words in that book, but...
Yeah, well, I was hoping you'd actually written a melody around this and I could get you to sing it.
Oh, yeah?
Let me turn to the page and see if there's anything you could do with this.
Oh, yeah, I remember this one. See, I forget most of the stuff that's in here, and then when I'd need a guitar, really. But I mean, what does a Grateful Dead song sound like? Kind of very boring to my imagination. So it would be kind of like antelope fire Indians sparkling on the tennis courts, diamond patent dancing on the hydrants and the shoe stores. I thought I heard a noodle sing. I sang like Greta Garbo. But I guess it doesn't matter anyway. Something like that.
That's very good.
I'm not very good with the Grateful Dead vocals, I'm afraid. But it's definitely outside my realm of experience or understanding.
You've said, and I guess people you've played with in the Mekons have said, that the band succeeded by failing. I mean, you've had your independence by not being indebted in one way or another to...
Yeah.
To a record company or, you know, commercial concerns and all of that.
We don't feel the need to treat it as a career.
Right. Now, say one day you became actually very successful within music, as improbable as that may seem, because you're, and I say that not because of a lack
untalented.
Of talent, no, but because of what you're doing isn't kind of seeking to be in the mainstream, and you're working with a lot of different idioms and so on. But say you really did strike that nerve, and your work really caught on in a very commercial way. Is that something you would finally welcome?
I don't know. Some friends of mine, Chumbawamba, have been playing for like 15 years, and they just ended up having a big hit last year. And I don't know how that will affect them or what that will do to them. It's put them in the public eye quite a lot, which is somewhere I certainly wouldn't want to be.
You've seen a lot of... I'm sure you've had a lot of friends who've become stars, big ones. How do you think it's changed them? I mean, do you think that inevitably changes people?
Yeah, I think so. There's a persona there that you have to kind of take on, and often it makes people a little bit. I mean, to the extent that Chumbawamba have become big stars on a one record, I mean, there may not be another record. It may just be a flash in the pan thing. I think it's made them kind of a little scared and very self-deprecating, you know, just wanting to not be in that position to some extent, but then driven on to do more and more crazy things like pouring buckets of water over Labour politicians and appearing on late night chat shows with Bill Maher and things like that. I don't know if that was to happen to the Mekons. I don't know. I just really can't see it happen. You'd have to ask me when it did happen, but I think it would change everything, and it might not be for the better.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best with your music and your art, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
John Langford is a co-founder of the Mekons. His solo record is called Skull Orchard. His Western Swing CD is called The Pine Valley Cosmonauts Salute the Majesty of Bob Wills. And his syndicated comic strip is collected in the new book Great Pop Things. Coming up, book critic Maureen Carrigan has some gift ideas. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has some holiday book-buying recommendations. They range from stories set in the Never Neverland of River Heights to the real-life saga of the literary Grand Dame of Jackson, Mississippi.
This anxious Christmas, when the looming threats of impeachment and war dominate the news, even those non-readers on your list might welcome the opportunity to bury their heads in a good book. So here are some choice picks of the season. Like her fellow Southerner Bill Clinton, Eudora Welty has always insisted that her private life is private. "I want my work to stand on its own," the 89-year-old Welty has said. Unlike Clinton, however, Welty is surrounded by an adoring circle of friends who've kept mum about whatever sins she may have committed. Faced with this code of silence, many a potential Welty biographer has turned tail and caught the next train home. But Anne Waldron has persevered to write an engaging, unauthorized biography of Welty, entitled simply Eudora. Don't expect any messy revelations here. Waldron concedes it's next to impossible to find out how Welty felt about growing up as a spectacularly homely girl who never dated, or why most of her closest friends were gay, or what the lowdown was on her intense relationship with fellow writer Elizabeth Bowen. But I agree with Waldron's suspicion that there may not be an awful lot more to know about Welty's personal life. "She has found adventure and passion in her work," Waldron says about Welty, and Waldron conveys that passion for a job well done. She follows Welty through the Depression years when she wrote for the WPA and traveled the South on her own. We also hear about the genesis of Welty's famous short stories, and lest we think her too angelic, her catty rivalry with Carson McCullers. Eudora is a refreshing break from all those Star Report quality biographies we've been assaulted with over the past decade. Without being unduly worshipful, Eudora pays its subject the compliment of defining her in her own hard-working terms. Southerners are also the main characters in The Poisonwood Bible, a superb novel by Barbara Kingsolver. Unlike Welty, however, who still lives in her childhood home, Kingsolver's fictional characters have roamed very far afield, winding up in the Congo in the early 1960s, just as that country is about to overthrow Belgian rule. The Price family has traveled to the jungle, carting quinine and boxes of Betty Crocker cake mix, on a religious mission. Nathan Price, the father, is a rogue evangelical minister, determined to baptize the heathens in the local crocodile-infested river. We're told that his abused wife can't figure out whether to view religion as a life insurance policy or a life sentence. The four Price daughters, three of whom are adolescents, take turns narrating the story, and the remarkable result is a sweeping novel of personal and political struggle that reads like Heart of Darkness crossed with Catcher in the Rye. Because books are scarce in the jungle, 15-year-old middle daughter, Leah Price, resorts to reading a cast-off Nancy Drew mystery. Before long, she's thoroughly engrossed in the adventures of the girl detective. If, like Leah, you've never outgrown your love for Nancy and her male compatriots, the Hardy Boys, treat yourself to a beautifully illustrated work of lighthearted cultural criticism entitled The Mysterious Case of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. Author sleuths Carol Kismarek and Marvin Hefferman have tracked down the various incarnations of the Hardys and Nancy since their debuts in 1927 and 1930, respectively. They also discuss the books in terms of our culture's changing notions about teenagers. But it's the illustrations here that are worth a thousand words. One look at Titian-haired Nancy kicking in a door with her dainty pumps, or Frank and Joe hurtling toward the ocean in a burning propeller plane, and you'll be transported back to a stout-hearted, simpler time. For today's more worldly-wise preteens, Holes by Louis Sachar is an amazing story about self-reliance, loyalty, and the whims of fate. It takes place in a boy's juvenile detention camp out in the snake-infested Texas wasteland. If that setting sounds too grim, know that this novel also magically wends its way through 19th-century Latvia and the Wild West. Holes recently won the National Book Award for Juvenile Fiction, but like the best so-called young adult books, it tells a marvelous story that will spellbind even those readers who last wrote a letter to Santa when Eudora Welty was in diapers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of John Harbison compositions featuring singers Dawn Upshaw and Lorraine Hunt. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
John Harbison is one of America's most honored composers, a recipient of both a Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Grant. He's about to celebrate a landmark birthday, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks Harbison couldn't receive a better present than his latest recording called At First Light.
John Harbison has been our most distinguished younger composer for so long, it's hard to believe that on December 20th he's turning 60. But he has reason to celebrate with the release of one of the best ever recordings of his music, At First Light, which features such notable singers as Lorraine Hunt and Dawn Upshaw. Hunt is best known for her riveting performances of Handel, but she's equally remarkable in contemporary music. Next year, she'll be making her Metropolitan Opera debut as Myrtle Wilson in the world premiere of Harbison's The Great Gatsby. On this new recording, she sings a work she premiered in 1989, Harbison's Chamber Orchestra version of books 3 and 4 of the Italian Nobel laureate Eugenio Montale's motets, his series of darkly cryptic and radiantly nostalgic short poems about a lost love. These songs are masterpieces of melody, color, invention, and poignant inwardness. I love the seductively rocking gondola in the first song, the quotation from the bell song from Lakmé in the second, all the aching evocations of Montale's heartbroken reminiscences. Hunt has a voice of molten gold, and she embraces, teases, lingers over, or flings out each syllable with passionate intelligence, a quality the greenleaf chamber players who accompany her also possess. The rest of the new Harbison album consists of 3 pieces with Harbison's favorite oboist, Peggy Pearson, and Scott Yu conducting the superb Metamorphosen Chamber Orchestra. Harbison calls Snow Country, which he wrote for Pearson in 1979, his winter pastoral. It takes off from where Schubert's unfinished symphony begins. Pearson gets to play one of the great long-breathed melodies in contemporary music. Thank you. Pearson also joins Dawn Upshaw in Harbison's Chorale Cantata, a 1994 piece modeled on Bach that alternates a chorale by Martin Luther with two brief, beautifully bleak poems by Michael Fried. Finally, Pearson and clarinetist Joanne Sternberg are the volatile protagonists in the comic and touching Concerto for Oboe and Clarinet from 1984. In his liner notes, Harbison mentions an astute writer who once referred to this piece as Scenes from a Marriage. Harbison has always been lucky with his performers, which is one more reason people love listening to his music. The ones on this new disc are both blissfully brilliant and, of course, uniquely authoritative. This is a sensational album. Happy birthday, John.
Lord Swartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed At First Light, a new recording of music by composer John Harbison with singers Lorraine Hunt and Dawn Upshaw and oboist Peggy Pearson. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and by Mannheim Steamroller, whose new release, The Christmas Angel, is available in music stores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.